Hello everyone, and welcome to Ghost Turd Stories. I'm your host, Troy Gent. Ghost Turd Stories' mission is using humorous and challenging stories from veterans and first responders to reduce the burden of families whose veteran or first responder took their own life. Ghost Turd Stories' vision is to use humorous and challenging stories to prevent suicide within our ranks and reduce the burden of families whose veteran or first responder took their own life. We hope to attract veterans and first responders, as well as those interested in knowing more about what it's like to be in our shoes while we wear or wore those shoes. At Ghost Turd Stories, we tell and write the stories of veterans and first responders for their families and friends. We love storytelling and believe there is nothing more inspiring and nothing that gets people to take action like a great story. Families and friends want to know the sacrifices we made, the services we rendered, and the people we lifted, so they can be inspired and learn about the legacy we left. Our podcast is the face of our company, but we want every family who cares to know about the experiences their veteran and or first responder went through for them. We interview veterans and first responders, collect pictures, write their stories, and compile them in a book for their families and friends to enjoy. Oftentimes, it's difficult for us to talk to our loved ones about what we did, saw, and heard while serving. At Ghost Turd Stories, we bridge the gap. For pricing, visit linktr.ee/ghostturdstories and click on the second tab directly under the podcast link called Let Us Write Your Story. That's linktr.ee/ghostturdstories. You were a police officer for 14 years, right?
Yeah, I was a police officer for 13. I did 3 years with one agency as a level one reserve, and then I moved over to another agency, which I worked over another 13 years. I'd retired from the Marine Corps. I knew that I was going to be a police officer, so I had used my active duty benefits to actually go through the police academy because they're all attached to a college. And I actually graduated from the police academy on an extended format. So what that meant was every Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, and all day Saturday, I was in the police academy after work. So Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, I would show up at 1800. So it went to like 6 to 10 on those days. And I did that for a whole year. In the same place, they had a fire academy. And be honest with you, the fire academy was way more militant than the police academy, which really surprised me. My wife told me, she goes, I know you're not going to listen to me, which she was right. But she says, I'd rather you be a fireman. So I thought, oh yeah, maybe she actually cares for me again. And she doesn't want me to get hurt because, you know, cops carry guns. We get in shootouts and so on. Nope, it wasn't true. She had a thing for firemen. So I'm like, yeah, whatever. So it was just being a police officer was my thing. So I ended up going to the police academy, and then I ended up going to one city, and I was working in it at the same time. I was kind of out processing, getting ready to leave the Marine Corps, vacate the Marine Corps, retire. I didn't get hired. I applied a couple of times to that agency for a full-time spot, and I got turned down. I disagree with the reasoning why, but I'm pretty sure I know why. You're not supposed to drive a bicycle on a sidewalk if you're an adult. And at night, you're supposed to have a light on it. And on this case, it was at the end of the shift, and I was going down this road, and I seen this guy actually riding a bike on the sidewalk. He didn't have a light. I whipped a U-turn. I was in a black and white. I ripped a U-turn and went back, and I put myself out on a bike stop. So I approached the guy, and he goes, hey, look, at I know I'm not supposed to be riding. He was an old guy, very poor guy. He had a place to live. He wasn't homeless, but he said, I've been at my girlfriend's house, and I'm driving. You know, I know I'm not supposed to be riding on the sidewalk, but I'm using the street lights because I know I'm supposed to have a light. And he pulls out of his bag, and he has this light, and he goes, the batteries were dead. So I know I'm doing this wrong and everything. And I said, yeah, hey, no problem. That's fine. You got your ID. And he pulls out his VA card. And I said, oh, appreciate that. But let me see your state ID. So he gives me that. So at that point, I had an FTO who was sitting there. Now, the FTO never did time in the military. So the guy wasn't a threat at all. Zero threat system. I know what a threat is. And I had already done a pat down, no weapons, no knives, no nothing. He was just trying to get home. So I had to put the check in the box. So I walked back to the car and I went to run him and I hear noise behind me. So I turned around and I see my FTO, and FTO stands for field training officer. He was going hands on with this guy, like scuffling with him. And he had actually gone on the ground. The guy was on the ground. It was passive resistance, you know. If you ever wrestle with your dad and he just kind of limps and you're trying to get control over him and you can't get your arms. And well, that's what this guy was doing. He was actually making a fool of my FTO. And he was trying to get him. And I'm like, wait a minute. So I walk over there to him and he looks at me. My FTO looks at me and says, get in on this now. And so I reached down and very calmly, I squatted down. I grabbed the guy's wrist and I said, dude, look at me. Just relax. Just relax. And he relaxed. And he goes, I don't know what the problem with your partner is. And the partner says, I'm the one in charge. And he goes, you're obviously not in charge. And I said, hey, just calm down. And I got handcuffs on him. And of course, he had called for code 3 cover. And later on told the sergeant because I left him in a fight by himself. So I was a reserve. I was a level 1 reserve, which is the same level as a full-time police officer. You have arresting authority and all that stuff. So it becomes an issue. So I go into the IA sergeant, and I actually came in to work that day. I had packed all my stuff in a box. I said, nope, not going to do it. And I walked in, and I put the box down. And he goes, let's talk. And he said, was the guy a threat? I said, not at all. And he goes, how come you didn't sit him on a curb? I said, he had a bad knee. And he goes, but he was riding a bike. And I said, I know. I've had bad ankles and bad knees. And the doctor says, go ride the stationary bike for strength. So to me, that means nothing. He goes, your partner said that you wouldn't jump in because he was a veteran. And I said, that had nothing to do with it. And he goes, well, he's pretty adamant that you chose a veteran over your partner. And I said, I would probably choose a veteran over him, but he was out of line. I said, he violated that guy's civil rights big time. There was no threat there and he should not have touched him. And I said, if this is the way law enforcement works, please accept all my stuff because I can't work under those conditions. The guy told me he knew he was doing wrong. He knew he was just trying to get home. And I said, the guy was just trying to get home. He had the light. Everything was fine with him. He wasn't being resistant. He wasn't being combative or anything. It's just that my FTO was one of these guys that pounded his chest and said, yeah, I'm a cop. You're going to do what I say one way or the other. And I'm in charge. And he was just one of these arrogant and had absolutely zero respect for military. He didn't like the military, had preferences when it came to hiring. And he said flat out, your military experience means nothing to me. He was just that way. He was just a dick. And so I was his first and last trainee. They asked me to go ahead and continue to stay on. But nevertheless, the reason why I told you that is because later on, I started applying for a full-time spot there at that police department, and I got turned down. I tried again, and I got turned down. So I'm sure that that situation had something to do with it. I ended up getting hired on by another police department that was closer to my home. They had a take-home car. It was really cool. I was there for a couple of years. They put me on the SWAT team. I ended up being a sniper again on the SWAT team. I was on the range staff and I was an armor. On top of that, I was doing patrol activities and stuff. So they had a program that they started off, which essentially was VICE. There's no other way to explain it. They didn't call it VICE, V-I-C-E. They didn't call it that. They called it a different name, but it was a street team, street impact team. And it was me and a younger guy. We were on the SWAT team together, so now we're in the same car. And we went out, and our first job was to reduce the amount of street prostitution. So we essentially went out and we started picking up hookers. which was cool. One of my friends, it was a sniper on the Riverside County Sheriff's team. He called me up and he goes, "Hey, I hear that you're working a street team where you're doing prostitutes and stuff." And I go, "Yeah." And he goes, "Finally, that Marine Corps grunt training is coming in handy." He goes, "Did you tell them in your interview for the job that you picked up hookers in several different countries and you're a black belt in it?" And I go, "No, dude, come on." So anyway, it was pretty fun. No hooker ever tried to kill me. So they were pretty fun to deal with. On a slow night when there wasn't a lot of girls walking on the streets because we'd made such an impact, we would sit in a car. Both of us had phones that were issued to us and that went back to nowhere, or one of our aliases. And we would set up dates and have the girls meet us at hotels. And so we would look at who was advertising, who was working in the city and all that stuff. And the thing is, you have to purposely misspell words and text messages and stuff so that they don't say, "Hey, it wasn't him I was talking to." No, look at it. They match up. This word's misspelled on both. And so, well, my partner, we would try and say something really crazy while we're picking up hookers. And so he was setting this date up with this one girl and he was on phone with her and he goes, "Hey, do you do themes?" And she goes, "Well, what do you have in mind?" He goes, "Hey, you know, I'm thinking, you got a maid outfit." And she goes, "Yeah, I can get a maid outfit." And he goes, "Oh, okay, you got to bring it. I got to see you in a maid outfit. I got to have it." And she goes, "Okay." And he goes, "Make sure you got high heels." He goes, "Oh yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Obviously." And then he says, "Oh, and bring a feather duster." And she goes, "A feather duster?" And he said, "Yeah." And she goes, "What's a feather duster for?" And he goes, "I can't explain it. I'll have to show you." So we wait and she comes walking. We see her and she comes walking and we're parked in a dark spot across the street from the hotel that we said we're going to meet her at. And she comes by. Well, we go up there and we stop her and we say, "Hey, what are you doing?" You know, and she goes, "Oh, no, I'm not prostituting." And I said, "Well, you got your prostitution clothes on her." And she was on formal probation. So we do a probation search on her stuff and she has the maid outfit in there, but she didn't have the feather duster because I think she, I don't know if she even knew what it was, but I always wanted to ask her because we don't want them to know that it's us because then they'll flag that phone number. So I was like, "Oh yeah, you got this maid outfit." And I said, "Don't tell me that you're going to go over to this hotel and be a maid, you know?" And she goes, "Are you guys the ones that called me?" And I go, "What? Why would we call you?" But she didn't have the feather duster. And I always wanted to ask her, "So how come you didn't bring the feather duster?" But the street prostitutes started keying on us. And when me and my partner had split, and we got in two cars, we would kind of try and box them in. We were low profile cars. And so we say, "Hey, I got one over here." And then we'd have to park, but they knew our cars. They knew us by name. So they knew what license plates of the cars that I did. And so there was this one girl, she was young. She was actually kind of attractive. So I knew she wasn't from the town I was working in. And I seen her walking and it was in the daylight. And so I'm like, "Yeah, let's go." Now, so I pull into the driveway of this business that she was walking by and I pop my door open. Did you kind of pop it open and you stand out? And she goes, "Oh my gosh, Brewer." And I said, "What? I just want to say hi, you know, acting stupid." And she goes, "Look it, I'm a hoe. You know I'm a hoe. I know I'm a hoe, but I'm not hoeing right now." And I go, "Well, you got your hoe clothes on." And she goes, "But I got to go get something to eat before I start hoeing. I wasn't going to start hoeing until I was down at this other intersection." And I said, "You know what? I tell you what, that was the best conversation I've had in 2 days. So I will let you go get your meal. But if I see you back over here, then I'm going to have to interrupt your business day." And she goes, "Thanks."
That's interesting with cops. I've heard stories like that before. Just their interactions with the criminal side is, it's almost like the criminals are like, "Oh yeah, that's so-and-so." And then it's almost like a game or something, you know, like it's good humor a lot of times with the lower level criminals. Is that true? Like lower level drug dealers, this and that, you're just kind of like, "Okay, I'm being good today."
Honestly, cops arrest the same people over and over. So you get to know each other and you know who each other are. Because I've contacted cops and I say, "When's the last time you arrested?" "Oh, blah, blah, arrested me last week and blah, blah, arrested me the last month. I got his trial coming up." And I'm like, oh, are you ready to catch a new case? Because that's their big thing. I caught a case and said, well, you want to catch another case? Well, no, but hey, brewer, where are you going to be? And I won't be where you're at. You know, and they would do that. So there was one guy that we get a call from. His wife says, yeah, he's domestic violence. He came home and he was fine. He was all pissed off and he's tearing up the house and beating her up and stuff like that. So we ended up going over there and she was gone. And she had actually, to get away from him, he was trying to close a garage door and she was backing out with the kids in the car and she took part of the garage door off. So she backed out and that's when she called us. So we go over there and he knew we were coming. You know, they also know that they're not going to, in a situation like that, everybody knows who they are and they know where they're at and they're not going to come out of this. So what he did was he went into the bedroom and just laid down on his bed, started to doze off. So when we got there, the bedroom had two big, there was a glass door that went out into a back patio and then there was a big window. So we went around to the back of the house where that window was, and we're looking through the window and I say, hey, look, he's in there. He's laying on the bed. And so he said, okay, we're going to go in. The window wasn't unlocked. Whether he kept it that way or whatever, I don't know. But we were able to unlock the window and open it up very calmly. I stepped through the window first, and another guy stepped through the window, and we went around to the bed, and I signed to him, I'm going to count to three. And on three, we're going to pounce on him on the bed. And he's snoozing. So I go really extravagant. And at the same time, because now stealth is no biggie, the other cops are going to come in. So I go one, two, three. Both of us jump on him and the fight's on. He knows exactly what's going on. He's not like, why are you in my house? You know, I'm going to sue you. None of that stuff. He starts hooking and jabbing and we're wrestling and and we're punching each other and we roll off the couch and he's giving a good showing for himself. And we get him finally, somebody puts a foot on his face and then we get him under control and we pick him up. He gets up and, you know, he's just talking his shit. Yeah, I got mine in, you know, blah, blah, blah. Shut up. No, I ain't going to shut up, blah, blah, blah. We get him back to the jailhouse and I'm booking him in and he's sitting on the little bench there. And I go, why'd you fight? And he goes, oh, come on. He goes, you guys work nights. And he goes, if I don't fight you, you're not exciting. And you know I have to fight you. It's always going to be a fight when you contact me, Brewer. You know that. He said, I can't go to county and go in there and say, well, did you fight the cops? And you say, no. Then you get dealt with there. And he goes, besides, it's exciting for me. It's exciting for you. And it's only a misdemeanor. And I was like, all right, dude. He told me flat out, he goes, you can't tell me you didn't have fun. Off the record, yeah, it was pretty cool, a little scaffolding, but they're pretty good. The ones that get really upset is when you start dipping into their business. You start taking girls off the street. The pimps get really, really pissed. They can't take it out on the police, so they take it out on the girls. The drugs, they get really pissed off because you take their drugs, you take their money, and you take them and put them in jail. So not only are they losing revenue, they just lost all of their money for that night, and they're not getting it back. So they get pretty pissed off. It's all fun and games, but it is a very, very dangerous thing. And it was, you know, during a knockdown, dragout fight is why I ended up being forced into retirement, because this guy was claiming to be a Marine. He was a big boy, and he wasn't a Marine, but he was making all kinds of threats. And his mattress in the room that he was living in was on the floor, wasn't in a bed frame. And he had this Marine Corps stuff all around his house, and his mom controlled the house. So my partner, who was Army Scout for a mechanized unit back in the day, he went and talked to the mom, and he came back to me, and he gives me the code that he was going to take him into custody. So I'm standing facing this guy, he's sitting down, and my partner gets up on the mattress and goes behind him and said, you're going with us, grabs his hand and gets one handcuff on one wrist, and then the fight was on. And it was very close proximity, so it was more of a wrestling match than a fight. And I was trying to hook his arm to get his handcuffs on him to control him, but I kept losing grip with my left hand on his. It kept slipping off and I couldn't figure out why. And he kept swinging like he was swimming. He kept swinging his arm. And my partner says very calmly, he's going for that gun. And I looked over and there's a pile of dirty laundry on the floor and I could see the pistol grip sticking out. And I'm like, oh, now you can't release what you have, because if he gets the gun and you release what you had and go to your guns, he's going to be able to get the gun and he's going to hurt somebody, my partner or me or something. So I can't release what I have because I have some kind of control. Well, during that fight, my thumb kind of hyperextended and folded back against my forearm and then popped back and it was injury. And then I worked on it for 4 more years till it deteriorated. They did surgery. And then, yes, by the way, we won the fight. I don't think, we won the fight. And so all things considered, there was one particular Mormon thing. Well, this was really funny because we had a sergeant. This guy, I loved working for him. He was just really fun. He was one of these guys that he comes from a family of cops, and he was just, back in the day, he was a hammer, a thumper when he was a cop, and you can't get away with that anymore. So he's just a really all around really good guy, and I just love the guy to pieces. So we get this call where this guy had gotten out of jail, and he went over to his family's house, lived in this really weird housing development where there was a bunch of duplexes, but they're kind of looks almost like a vacation type thing with little sidewalks in them. They're all single story. And so we get there. Oh, he's tearing things up. He's threatening. And he says he's going to do this and do that. And I said, whatever. So I get there. Well, at the time, me and there's this one other guy that worked on it. We're the only two Mormons there. And both of us happen to be returned missionaries. And so we get there together and we walk over to his dad's house. And his dad says, I don't know where the hell he went. He took off and he started running around. I don't know where he's going. So as we're walking out to look at the area, me and this cop, and I go to this open door that has a man and this very young little girl with him. And the girl is just wedged up against her dad and her eyes just said fear. She was too afraid to cry. And her dad was like, just his eyes were real big and they were just frozen in time. That's not right. So I pointed and said in a whisper, is he in there? And he said very calm. He shook his head very calmly, yes. And I said, do you know him? And he shook his head, no. So this guy had actually run into that house. Now, this apartment, when you walk in, has a very narrow hallway for several feet before on the left side, it opens up in the kitchen. And if you keep going straight, it opens up in the living room. These apartments also have a sliding glass door in the back that has a very small, maybe a 5 feet by 10 feet little patio thing on the back that has this big fence around it. So you could put a little puppy out there to run around. Right next to that sliding glass door in this particular thing was a terrarium. And so I said, can we come in? And he goes, yes. And so he takes his little daughter and they glue themselves as much as they can against the wall. Now, I couldn't stand abreast with the other two cops that were with me. But the other Mormon was on my left side and this other guy was on my right. I was in the front and we were kind of staggered because that was the only way to get into the hallway. Well, the guy was hiding behind the curtains of the sliding glass door and he knew it was done. So he flips open these curtains and he's all tatted out from his neck down to his chest, doesn't have a shirt on, and he keys on me. And he yells out, he goes, yeah, and, you know, grunt, and he takes off at a sprint. I take off at a sprint because in my mind, I can't get to my gun or my taser. In my mind, I'm going to run up and I am going to punch him in his face as hard as I can with everything I have. So we are in this really short thing and we are just sprinting towards each other. And I hear this Mormon go, stop or I'll tase you, pop. And holy I crap. See those darts go right by my head. And it hits the subject at the same time as I come in contact with the subject. So now I'm getting tased, but the darts are in him. We roll. He hits that terrarium. It goes off the road. Now you got shattered glass, and he doesn't have a shirt on. And so he's getting cut. The first 5 seconds because they only ride 5 seconds, stops. The guy turns around and takes a swing. I managed to catch his arm and I'm punching him. And he hits the trigger again for another 5 second ride. And I'm getting tased again with him. And then that 5 second ride goes and he yells at me. My partner yells at me and goes, handcuff him. And I yell back, stop tasing me.
That's hilarious.
We finally get handcuffs on the guy and we pick him up. Now, my uniform's all discombobulated, right? Because of this little scuffle. And he still has these darts with the wires hanging out of him. And he's all cut up. Me and the other guy, we got him on each arm. And as we're walking him out of the apartment and we're outside, that sergeant pulls up and he goes, what the hell happened? He goes, oh, he decided to fight it. And he looks at the guy and he goes, what the hell did you do to piss off these two Mormons? And he looks at us and goes, you guys are Mormon?
That's pretty funny. Go,
yeah, you want to book a Mormon? And then when we were back in and I was booking him, he goes, are you guys seriously Mormon? Yeah, we are. He goes, well, you guys can fight for Mormons. And I go, yeah, how many Mormons have you ever fought? I mean, how do you know we all can't fight?
I've been using Isagenics since 2017. These products have made a world of difference in my quality of life, health, energy, muscle definition, strength, and endurance. My bread and butter products have been the Daily Essentials Multivitamins with Isagenesis, which is a telomere support supplement, the Isolene Meal Replacement Shake, the Tri-Release Protein Shake, the Collagen, the Green Drink, and the Cleanse for Life support system. However, Isagenics has many products and can cater to your unique lifestyle and goals. Click the link in the show notes or visit nmp.isagenics.com. Besides just using the products, there is an option to partner with me and the company to build your own business with no capital upfront. You can do as little as pay for your products and as much as making a full-time income. I love these products and will use them the rest of my life. For more information, you can email me at ghostturdstories@gmail.com.
Well, hey, Tim, if you feel comfortable, talk a little bit about maybe some of the post-traumatic stress you experienced and then how you managed it or overcame it.
I'll set it up just a little bit, a Reader's Digest. I come from a very abusive home. It's a broken home and very abusive. So it was a lot of hands-on, a lot of alcohol. Trauma was no different for me. We didn't call it then. Honestly, I thought that was normal. All me and my siblings all thought it was normal. That was just the way life was. Mom didn't have dinner ready. She got her ass beat. We knew it was wrong. I've never talked to my brothers or sister about it. But me personally, I didn't see the intent behind it. I didn't see the purpose behind beating up Mom. I didn't see the purpose in slapping me across the face, punching me, or even grabbing a belt and laying it across my bare ass. I never seen a purpose in that because it didn't deter behavior, at least not in us. He got a family of boys. We continued doing what we did. We just got really, really secretive about it. And we learned a lie. You know, going into the Marine Corps, I can say the first combat zone I was in the 80s in 1986 when the Philippines was being plagued with a communist movement, but they also, we know now, had ties to Al-Qaeda, but the majority, they were claiming political power and they were trying a couple of coups on the government. I was at an 81 millimeter mortar platoon and with the deployed unit. At the time, it was one of the first MEU SOC special operations capable units to go out. The way it worked was we got the mission from whoever gives out missions. NSA had something to do with it. We go into this meeting about, you know, this is a real mission. We're not taking 81 mortars. We're going conventional. The companies divided up, took different areas in the jungle behind along the whole Philippines. They had planted some IEDs on that base. A couple of Navy guys had been killed. A couple of Air Force guys got killed in the Air Force base. So we went in to flush these guys out. That was our job. So we landed on these hilltops and it was double and triple canopy jungle. And when we landed, the lieutenant says, hey, I want all the squad leaders over here. And so we all go over there and collected up all the ammunition. No, we weren't locked and loaded when we went there, because at that point we didn't know. We Marines did not know it was a real mission. So we all come over there, and as we're getting the op plan, we're loading magazines. None of the guns were loaded. And so the rules of engagement were this: when we see the enemy and we're being fired upon, we had to positively identify not only who was firing it, but who they were, ensure that they were the enemy, make our way individually to our squad leaders and be issued one magazine, and return fire only to reduce the threat. It was really kind of a weird thing. And I'm like, this is a real thing. And I was a young corporal. So I sat in a fighting hole for two nights up there on that hill, and it was Philippines, so it rains a lot. So the fighting hole kind of filled halfway up with water. And so I'm sitting in this warm water, totally soaking wet. And we would send out patrols around into the jungles and stuff. We pushed them around, but we never had contact. And then we went back and, you know, life goes on. Well, I had told that story to many different people over the years. And one day I'm talking to a VA doctor, my primary care physician, and she goes, have you ever talked to anybody from MHU? And I said, you know, mental health unit. And I said, no. And I go, why would you ask that? And she goes, because that story you just told me scared the shit out of me. Well, first of all, she's a little Indian lady, and she said shit. So I knew that something wasn't right. She had asked me about my first deployment. She goes, how was your first deployment in the Marine Corps? As she was writing on her computer. And so it went to that. So the referral went in. I ended up getting into it with the first guy I talked to who would interrupt me, and it was just messed up. So I said I wasn't going to go back, and I ended up talking to another guy that says, hey, I'm sorry, that guy should have done this. And that guy ended up calling me and apologizing with me. That's an individual thing. It's not so much. I thought they were going to help me, and this guy wasn't there to help. He was there to put a pencil to paper and just shove you on to the next. Okay, go to that chair and sit down until they call you from that office type thing. He wasn't there to help anybody out. And I was told he was a counselor and he was going to talk to me and all that stuff. I ended up as an overflow, the doctor near where I live who had used to be in the Navy, and he worked at Bethesda. He was a psychologist, and since then he's become a really good dear friend of mine, but I ended up seeing him. And we went through that, and he asked me when I told him that story, because he said, why are you here? And I went in there flat out, crossed arms, crossed legs, saying there's nothing wrong with me. I'm just one of those guys that nothing affects. And to add to that story, one time when I get called in by my sergeant at the police department, and he goes, hey, Timmy, I want you to go over here and replace this officer. He says the name of him. He said, because he's on a dead body and he won't go into the house. I go, why? He said, I know this kind of stuff doesn't bother you. And I go, no. And he says, go ahead and go in there. So I go over there, and it was a LA County Sheriff deputy that had retired years prior to that. And he killed himself with his service rifle or service pistol, but he had been laying there for a little while. So it was a stinker. We call it in the police department, they'll say, oh yeah, it was a stinker. His skull cap, the skin had folded out and was literally dripping stuff, and it was a pretty gruesome and smelly scene. And the coroner got there, and me and the coroner, but when I first made contact with the police officer, he goes, you're not going to want to go in there. And I go, why not? And he goes, because can't you smell it? And I go, yeah. And he goes, that's why I'm not going to go in there. And I go, what are you, a puss? I go ahead, go, I got this, go. And then I go in there, and he said later on, he goes, there's something wrong with you if you think that that's no big. And I go, that's our job, dude. We go to dead bodies. We see death, mangulated, rape kids. Well, that's what we do. I told those two stories rather over a period of time. And he said a couple of good things because I didn't know that was wrong. I didn't know. I thought, you know, that stuff doesn't bother me. And then he said about the Philippine incident, he goes, how'd that make you feel? And I go, I didn't care. It was just the way it was. It was normal. Just like, again, that same mentality when I was growing up. It was normal. Yeah, your dad smacked you around like this. What'd make you feel? You know, that was normal. And so now this thing in the Philippines, how'd you make you feel? And I go, that's normal. Why do you guys keep asking me these stupid questions? He said, why do you think? He goes, stop and think about what was going on at that time, which I had never done before. And he goes, why do you think the rules of engagement were that? And I go, I don't know. And he goes, think about it. Just sit here and think about it, is what he wanted me to do. Now, what he was trying to do is bring these depressed memories to the surface so I could deal with them so they wouldn't come back later on. When that particular piece of information surfaced, I was a mess. I really was. Because I had this huge respect and admiration to the federal government. I absolutely loved the Marine Corps. And no way would these two combination take a boy like me and put me in the danger without a purpose. And I said, I think the government, including the NSA, was trying to get one of us killed so they could justify full combat action in that region. The doctor said, that sounds plausible. How come you haven't thought about that before? And I go, I don't know. So we talked a little bit more. The government was trying to do it. They did a coup, you know, and the Americans are like, why are we over there? Why are we doing this and stuff? What's the easiest way? Send in a combat unit, get a couple of them killed. Now they're killing our Marines. Look what they did. They don't say our Marines were unloaded. Their ammunition were zip tied in the cans. They don't give that information to the public. They just say, hey, these guys hit our base and killed a couple of Marines. We need to send more battalions over there to justify that. And it's like unmasking, almost like unmasking your superhero and finding out it's somebody you wished it wasn't. You're like, holy crap, man, these guys did that to me? It took me a while to figure that out. You know, when we started talking about police, I said, yeah, but things, I was still stuck in this, you know, things still don't bother me. And I told him about that one story about that one particular guy. And he goes, on your way home, what were you thinking? What were the thoughts going through your mind? I said, I was thinking, I'm really hungry and I just hope my wife had cooked something to eat. He goes, was it anything in particular? And I go, no, I was just really hungry. Because when you go into a place like that and it's really, really bad, the smell that you have is actually particulates that are embedding in your nose. That's why it stays with you for several days afterwards. Your body has to blow all those things out. And I was thinking, yeah, if I eat, I just, and maybe that could get the smell out of my nose a little bit. And then that was it. And then I just went. And then I go back. You see your dead baby. The first really dead baby I seen was a week or two old. And the mom and dad was like happy that she wasn't pregnant no more. So they got high on meth. And then they crashed and kept the baby in the bed. She rolled over and crushed it. And that baby was flat when I went up. And I'm like, they killed their kid. And I'm like, oh, that poor kid, man. At least he doesn't have to be. That was my takeaway. At least he doesn't have to be raised around those idiots, you know. And I was fine with that. I would move on. But you see stuff like that, and you see the horrible things that human beings do to each other. Because in the Marine Corps, I knew what the horrible things that human beings do to each other. But as a police officer, I seen the horrible things that people do to the people they love. That was harder for me to deal with. That was really hard for me because I lost faith in love. There was no love. Marriage was a contract, and I still look at it that way. It's just a contract. To watch and walk into some of these houses and see the horrible things that people do to each other that they claim to love is just absolutely horrendous. Sitting there face to face with a guy that been victimizing his blood daughter for several years, and him telling me, justifying it was, I wanted to teach her what a real man is like. And then seeing her with her little siblings in the waiting room waiting for CPS to come, in tears, that young girl would ask me, when can I see my daddy? How do you tell her? Sweetheart, your daddy victimized you. He hurts you. You go home and you look at your own daughter and you think, gosh, dang, how do you look at your daughter that way? How do you do that? That girl, that particular girl was so tore up internally, she could never have kids. And the abuse was so long. And I just, looked at my kids and I just, it's hard. It's really hard. And you stew on that and you can't tell anybody. You can't walk into your house and say, well, I talked to this guy and check out what he did. You know, you can't, it's not like, you know, hey, this guy cut me off and then he crashed. Yeah, karma. You know, it's not like that. If these people knew exactly the level of abuse, they wouldn't be up there fighting for smaller jail terms. In the Marine Corps, I had a really good friend. His name is Jim. Jim and me had met years ago when we were both first in the Marine Corps. He had been in the Army and then took a leave of absence and went on a mission to Japan. And then I actually went on a mission and then I came back and went to whatever and then joined the Marine Corps. And we found ourselves in Adak, Alaska together, gardening some pretty cool stuff. And he was actually, he comes from a very prestigious family in Utah. Him and me took a liking to each other and we kept in contact forever. He was a scout sniper and then I was a scout sniper. He ended up getting out of the active duty, but stayed in the reserve unit and became a Salt Lake City police and was on a SWAT team. And he was a sniper there. And he and I stayed in contact. And anyway, his unit got activated to go into the second push. And they were activating reserve units only for a year or a year and a half, 18 months. And then they were deactivating them again and getting somebody else to come and replace them. But he come from the infantry unit that's stationed out of Utah right there around Salt Lake City, something like that. And he was in a regular line company. So he was over in 1st Marine Regiment. And when regiment pulled chocks and left, he was supposed to go back to Utah. He was actually, his unit was slotted to go to Utah and they came before, they had already packed up all their gear and get ready to go. And they came the day before they left to go into the Gulf. They came back and said, hey, you just got extended. We are going to support 1st Marine Division in combat operations in Iraq. And so he pulled up chocks and off to Iraq he goes. He ends up being killed outside of Nasiriya. And the way I found out, because I didn't know his unit had remained on active duty, I sent an email to him and said, hey, idiot, where the hell are you? We need to meet up at our first chance. And I get an email from his sister that says, I guess you haven't heard, and sends me the notice. I got to tell you, it hit me like a sack of rocks because I wasn't there with him. And the way he went out, he was responding to fire. She ended up calling me and she goes, we had no idea that he actually had other LDS friends. I was the only one. I said, we've been friends forever. And she said, we have heard about you, but no one knew who you were. And so I ended up going to Utah when his body came back. When I finally talked about that, because I kept that inside for a long time, that whole situation, I didn't talk to anybody about it. But when I finally talked to somebody about it, I said, I think the entire chi of this earth had changed because Jim died and I didn't. And it was rough. I still struggle with it from time to time. And then shortly after Jim, another friend of mine who got me interested in going to the police academy and everything, he was another guy that was retiring. And then he was going to work at Anaheim City Police. He took an RPG fragment in his head and lived for 3 days before he died. And I ended up going and attending him. And I couldn't handle it. It was so difficult. And you can't go, because here's your loved ones around. My wife, she doesn't understand it. She's been married to me since I was a corporal, but she doesn't understand that. She doesn't. I don't talk to her about it. I don't talk to her about the stuff I dealt with as a cop. Her answer is extremely black and white. And I say, yeah, I'm having a hard time dealing with that. And she says flat out, like most people do, well, live your life so they will be proud of you. Live your life so they would be proud of you. In other words, don't live your life for yourself. Don't figure out how to deal with it and you progress. Live your life the way they want you to live. So lose yourself to become what you think they are. And that's exactly what you're saying when you say, you know, I live in. And I had a hard time with that, and I still do. And it's still a topic of discussion when I talk to a psychologist, but he's the only one I really talk to. I don't talk to anybody else around here. And when I was on the SWAT team, they would ask me, oh, I want to get Brewer drunk because I want him to tell me some stories. And I said, I will never do that. I will never do that for two reasons. Number one, I don't drink. And number two, you don't rate to hear my stories. You haven't been there. You would never understand.
So what, you talk to your psychologist, but what are some things personally that you do to manage that survivor's guilt and the post-traumatic stress?
I found that, and it really, really hit me hard when I was forced to retire from the police department because of my wrist. And the first couple of days, it's like you're on a weekend. And then I went into a really dark place, not because, oh, I miss being a cop. None of that stuff. It was your sense of purpose. And what right do I have to enjoy this life at this point? I didn't win any battles. I didn't get any bronze stars, silver stars. I didn't drag anybody out of a mortar pit. What right do I have to live? And so I go into a really dark place, and a lot of times I would sit in my garage with the lights off and the TV off, and I would just sit there, sleep really late, get up, not eating. And it just so happens because when I was forced to retire, you get these, because I got what they call an IDR, which is an industrial disability retirement, you get some kind of benefits through the state on going to school. Plus I had the VA benefit. And so some obscure guy called me and he'd say, hey, you got these benefits. And I'd say, yeah, don't call me no more. And I'd hang up. He called me back again and I'd hang up on him again. And about the fourth or fifth time he called me, I said, why do you keep calling me? And he said, because these benefits are there. And I said, look it, give them to somebody else. And he goes, they don't go to somebody else. They're yours. And that was really difficult for me to grasp. You know, and I hear this from a lot of vets. Well, I don't want to take a VA disability, give it to the guys that came back with no arms, no legs, etc. And they go, well, look, here's the deal, is that they have their educational benefit. These educational benefits are for you. You can't move these anywhere else. If you don't use them, they just don't get used, period. They don't go back. That money doesn't go back in some magic pot where somebody else will draw from it. If you don't use them, they just don't get used. And that was what the situation was. And so I listened to him for a little bit and I said, all right, let me do this. And I'll be honest with you, it was kind of a half-ass effort, but it seemed to be, the process seemed to be rather simple in registering for school and stuff like that. And I thought to myself, well, what am I going to do? Well, I have no high frequency hearing because of all the loud noises. My ears were damaged. So I said, you know, I'm going to go ahead and learn sign language. And so my first class, in college over here was ASL 1, American Sign Language 1. And I sat in the back of the classroom and I looked around and I seen all these little kids. I was thinking, here I was with a USMC hat on, my beard. I was like, what the hell are you doing? Honestly, if it would have been any one of my professors I have had since 2017, I would have probably walked out. This professor, it just seemed like a perfect storm. When he walked in, I thought he was the janitor. He was an older guy, slightly younger than me, it turns out. Had his hat, a baseball cap on. He had a t-shirt and jeans. He got up there, and that first day, he had interpreters. And so I thought, this is interesting. And so he actually did his little thing. And I thought, you know what? I don't want to say I was impressed with him, but I want to say that he actually impacted something in me. And I go, you know, I'm going to come back and listen to this guy again. And so the next time I come back, there was no interpreters. So he goes chalkboard. It's really kind of weird when you're in ASL 1 because it's a combination of memorization of signs and stuff like that. I'm still sitting in the back trying to stay quiet. And he sees me down the aisle. And he signs to me, and it is broken because he's profoundly deaf. He has a cochlear implant. In front of the whole class, he points to me and says, why are you here? I look around, and I point to me, and I go, are you talking to me? He goes, yes, why are you here? I signed to him in very rudimentary signs, I cannot hear high frequency and I cannot understand words. And he said, okay. And so after that class, he stopped me and he said, asked me where I come from and how come I can't hear, and told him that. Turns out his father was a Marine. It turns out that this guy woke up one day at 4 years old. He had perfect hearing, and at 4 years old, he woke up and he couldn't hear anything, and no one knows why. He met his wife. She's profoundly deaf. They both have a hearing son who is in OCS right now for Marine Corps. Since 2017, he has been a very dear friend of mine, and he has helped me navigate through this ASL language. He tutors me. He does all this stuff, and he doesn't ask for anything in return other than good conversation. Education, I found, kept my mind busy. Learning a new language was only the beginning, because I started saying, hey, maybe I can get a degree. And then my mind changed. So I know I was coming out of that dark spot and I had different goals.
You're starting to find purpose again.
Exactly. It was almost like, hey, Jimbo, look at me, man. I'm going to school. I met some friends and I impressed, and my wife would think it's funny because she goes, you know, your dad tells the kids, your dad makes friends with all of his teachers. And I go, yeah, because they're the ones my age. So I started taking general education and ended up being transferred over to the university and University of Redlands, and got a bachelor's degree in international business, which, by the way, is all, every class is a math class. And I was always nervous about math. And my kids ended up, my oldest son helped me through all that stuff. They bought me a very expensive calculator. And I was so fascinated in the fact that I understood business calculus and probability formulas. My son was a black belt in it. He was a math major at UCSD. So he was all excited that his dad was learning his math. And it got to the point towards the end of that, I was getting really nervous because I didn't want to return to the dark. And I'm like, I got to go do something else. And the VA authorized my deaf studies at a different college, at Palomar College. And so I switched over to there and I took a couple of classes. Now I'm taking my last and final class. And now it's taken me, I've been in college since 2017 using the VA benefits. And now I'm thinking, not, you know, returning to the dark spot, I'm thinking, what can I do? Advocate for the deaf community, the VA deaf community, and all this other stuff. When I go into those moments, I like to work with old wood. Old wood, people like pallet wood, wood that people throw in the garbage. I pulled pallets out of old fields, dusted off the dirt, made tables out of them. I made these little boxes, and I wrote this little article about the boxes, about why I like making things out of old wood that people throw away, and working with that old wood and making it into something useful and beautiful. And something old doesn't necessarily has to be thrown away. It can be refurbished. And I have these woods, and I just recently made a table out of an old motorcycle tire and wood. And those things keep me busy. For a while, I was having a problem completing sentences. It would be in my head that was right, but it wasn't coming out of my mouth. So the VA did this whole CAT scan thing and look for brain tumors and all that stuff. And I was ended up talking to a psychologist, and I said, I don't know what it is. Maybe I'm thinking faster than I can talk, but I can't get these thoughts. There's a lag time. And then my speech wasn't clear. And I said, I don't know what to do. And so he said, you know, you've been teaching your whole life in one form or another. What you need to do is find a platform where you can teach what you know. Because one of your biggest problems, he said, is nobody listens to you. He goes, that's what you believe. No one listens to you. That's what's causing a lot of your problems. And you're silent in a crowd because you've come to the conclusion that one's going to listen to you, or you don't have anything good to input. And he told me that find a platform where you can teach small lessons, but they can't ask you questions. Because that's where your mind and your mouth aren't connecting. And one of my sons says, just start an Instagram page and give advice. I go, on what? And he goes, on guns. Give advice on gun ownership and stuff. It's what you know. So I did it, and my oldest son actually looks at it and he likes it. And then my number two son is actually gay, and his boyfriend, he follows my Instagram page. And somebody was asking him, "Do you follow the Instagram page?" He goes, "Yes." And I watch every video, and he goes, "I know more about gun and gun ownership in California than I ever thought I would." But they're small little 4 and 5 minute blurbs, and it helped me be able to channel and coordinate that thought process.
You know, Tim, I think the greatest thing we can do for ourselves, our mental health, is, like you said, to find purpose. We find purpose and we're contributing. And when we contribute, we feel a lot better about ourselves.
That's absolutely true. The whole, why am I here and how come these things happen? Those are all circumstances that are out of our ability to change. And one of the things Dr. Diamond told me, and he goes, one of the things you do is bring those memories you don't want to think about to the front part of your brain where you think about them all the time, because the more you think about them, the less important and intrusive they become. So I was having nightmares constantly, and he said, keep a pad of paper and pen by your bed. And when you wake up from these nightmares, immediately write down everything you can remember. Do it in story form or whatever. I said, and then burn it. And he goes, no, keep it. He goes, because I had recurring nightmares. And he said, by writing it down, you're pulling those subconscious minds out. And he told me, he goes, nightmares are a way that the brain tries to heal itself. And this is the expression, whether it's true or not, I don't know, but it makes sense. He goes, if you're having nightmares, the brain is dealing with memories and things that doesn't make sense. And so it fixes itself by bringing it into dreams. Your subconscious mind takes over because that's where we press it and you dream it. And if you keep it in your conscious mind, it comes less controlling. Now, I still get nightmares, but I don't get them as often. And there's certain things that will always bring a tear to my eye that I don't know why, but I'm very careful about being around people. I won't do it around people. If I feel myself starting to do that, and this is another thing we do something drastic to change our way of thinking. Maybe punch a table, you know, just kind of thump on a table, or say something stupid so you redirect your brain or something like that. I'm not very good at dealing with those. I won't go into a Burger King and sit down and eat a sandwich. I will go through a drive-thru and eat and get a Whopper and leave, but I won't go into a Burger King and sit down. Because one of the last really heart-to-heart talks that me and Jim had was sitting in a Burger King. We were both eating Whoppers. And I asked him, I said, I understand that when people die, maybe we go to heaven, maybe we don't. But if there is a community after we die and somebody plays an instrument or sings, I can see how they would have a place in that. But what about us? What about us? We're infantry. Our job is very specific, and it's not something we do 24/7. What do we bring to a heavenly community? We won't have a job. We won't have a purpose. And Jim said, don't worry about it. There will always be a need for warriors. And I said, I'll take your word for it. He was much smarter than me. I've always tried to live like that, that yeah, I'm old. I can't run as fast and I can't jump as far. but I always consider myself a combatant still, a warrior of some kind.
Well, Tim, what you shared was incredible, and really, really appreciate you being my guest. And I'm glad to know you now, and you got a new friend. So thank you for listening. Please tell your friends and family so that we can bring more joy and awareness to those struggling with suicide ideation and the families who desperately need help after the loss of someone they love to suicide.